Hey everyone, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, where we discuss the latest DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SweetOps community. Plus, we'll have a live Q&A at the end. So if you have any questions, please post those in the chat. Today is May 14th, 2025. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps. I haven't said that enough times in my life. We're a DevOps accelerator for AWS infrastructure that helps teams deploy their software faster. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been downloaded over 100 million times. So to learn more about that, just go to cloudposse.com. We got everything there. So how can you maximize today's session? Well, first off, our format is very informal. You can engage as much as you'd like and ask questions. And for those of you on the recording, we host these calls live. So just go to cloudposse.com/officehours to subscribe. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, please share it with your team. We'll be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/cloudposse. So with that said, let's see what caught my attention this week. All right, first one is OpenEOX or OpenEOX. I always like to pronounce my acronyms. This is a new initiative backed by apparently some major players here at trying to improve how end of life or end of support announcements are made. As the supply chain is getting deeper and deeper and deeper, and you know, projects inevitably reach end of life, some way of communicating this, almost like what you have with an SBOM, would be a good way to do that. So I haven't looked into the technical details of how this goes, but standardizing how this works rather than a bunch of like GitHub repos, like awesome lists that just syndicate like AWS deprecated services or things like that isn't ideal. Now, that's just one small case and that might not even be communicated by this, but you know, specifically software packages, modules, other dependencies, a way of communicating that they are end of life would be good. Anyone looked into this anymore?
Sounds like an interesting first step, I guess. How to consume it, what to do about it, everything else at that point is a different, a different problem. But at least, the first step of dealing with a problem is admitting you have a problem. And oftentimes you don't know you have a problem if you don't know something's end of life that you rely on. So this
That
would
is
be a
true.
good this would be a good start in that direction.
I wonder if license change could also fall within the scope of end of life. Well, I think that it should not be lumped up with end of life, but change of license maybe or other things like that. But that should just fall into play with how the software dependency chains work anyways, because with the SPD, was it SPDX header, that should be available already. And I don't know that a specific change needs to be announced so much as you need to remain compliant. And the only way to do that is scan that the licenses in your dependencies are of your list of approved licenses. But overall, I think, some standardized way of doing, well, there's no standardized way truly to do this, but a JSON schema for defining this that then individual languages, package managers, and tooling can adopt.
Yeah, I think the logical place for both of the things we just talked about is actually the package manager. So if if you're in the JavaScript, as an example, and you're using Yarn or Bun or NPM or one of those, and you could opt into licenses that licenses that you support or you'll accept, and then also when you run npm install of it or bun install or whatever, it would tell you like, hey, you're relying on this package that's no longer supported. Do you want to look for an alternative or something like that? That would actually be a great enhancement.
would be so awesome. And when you say it like that, I'm surprised that they don't support that because license compliance is getting harder and harder as more licenses and frankly projects are switching licenses. Duffy?
I feel like there's a bit of a source of truth problem there, though. Like, I mean, is the abbreviation for a license in a JSON file, legally binding? If I go and modify an MIT license or a GPL license or an Apache license, and you don't detect it, and I've put it in my README, how do you
Well, it
know
used to
what my
be,
license is, right?
right. I mean, so what is the source of truth? And the source of truth ultimately needs to be, well, in the naive sense, for since to me that my worldview is GitHub and nothing else, it is what the license is on GitHub. But yeah, what is a canonical registry, if you will, for licenses of some software that you can reference against?
Yeah, I think someone, so I think you're referring to like in package.json, there's also a license field on there that you fill out. And I think someone would have a reasonable argument that if the package.json said one thing and the README or the license.md or just the license plain file without an extension said something different, you could very easily argue that the license was ambiguous and you were following the guidance of what the package manager said that the license was, because ultimately the author is in control of that field in the license or in the package.json in this case. But there's the same thing for many other package managers as well. I'm just using JavaScript as an example in this case.
It brings a point that, like Terraform, for example, which is pretty n young in terms, it's not young actually in terms of years for a language anymore. It's 10 years old, but it doesn't have that, right? No way to publicly convey what license a module is, for example. And
True.
recently I came across some modules that were licensed. I thought it was bold, but yeah, like, this is free for your personal use, but if you're using this, in your company, you can't use this module. I forget which license it was, basing it on.
Yeah, and there are others in the industry that certainly sell modules as, a
Yeah, true.
subscription service and things. So, there should definitely be a way to express that somehow within, within Terraform. That would be, I think, just like you can with it, should be able to do with any other package manager. So,
Yeah. All right. Any more on this one? Let's see what was in the chat here. Nope, just the spam from the Fireflies and Read AI. Oh, Hamza was asking how to join the Slack channel, or that was last week. So sorry, didn't see that till now. Scrolling down.
I answered it last week, I
Oh,
believe.
you did. Okay,
Yeah.
cool. Thanks. I see Anthony's joined us. He says his team is new to, well, Anthony, we'll get to your question during the Q&A, which comes after we discuss the announcement. So probably in like 20 minutes or so. All right, let me come back to this. Okay, so the next one was something caught my attention on LinkedIn. It's an AWS lab or samples project, so not even labs, on generating AWS solutions. So presumably CloudFormation architectures through prompting. This is a big thing on AWS that they have, endless amounts of architectures that they publish, but don't maintain. And yeah, it can be overwhelming. So yeah, something new that I learned. I don't know if I had ever questioned it, why you don't see any TLDs used without dots when technically it's totally valid by the DNS protocol. It's just that it's something that ICANN itself prohibits, which is the governing body of top-level domains. But they can't necessarily dictate what individual countries do. So therefore, country domains can have dotless domains. And apparently, there's an example here, like MR as a top-level domain. So here's the exhaustive list, apparently, of dotless domains that you can explore.
Where's MR?
Yeah, Mauritania, but I don't know why Mauritania is not listed here.
That's what I oh, that
Oh,
wasn't the
here, okay.
exhaustive list, I guess.
Historical, but they no longer do so. Is MR here? No.
No, it's not there either.
Here's
So.
MR. MX only. Okay.
Ah, interesting.
So that's the ultimate baller domain, though. You know, you don't even have a dot in your domain.
The one thing I would say is dating myself back when I used to do a lot of work in the Windows world, that was actually pretty
Right.
popular to do internally. So you
Yeah.
just like give like a server name with no node name at the end, and DNS, well, it was using like WINS resolution or whatever at the time, and it wouldn't actually append like your search domains or anything on
Name.
it. It would actually just use that particular entry, whatever. I don't know what we call that thing, whatever, a domain without a dot. A dotless TD, I don't know, whatever.
This would have been cool. right, so Cameroon. So this is the ultimate scammer's domain, CM. Is that what?
They should probably, whoever that was it Antigua that it said was AI or something like that?
Yeah.
They should go sell that TLD to like OpenAI or someone for
Yeah.
like for more than the GDP of their country, and
Yeah.
they could probably do it.
I think we saw something in the news that said .AI domains were actually contributing quite a bit
No,
to a particular country.
not dot AI, actually just AI with no dot in it.
Well, that would be the So I mean, that would be the registrar owning the .AI TLD. They are the same, right? The registrar issuing domains on .AI is the same one that could have theoretically AI as its.
No, dot AI is a different TLD than AI.
No, AI is the TLD.
No, what with no dots? With the one with no dots, right? So,
But that's because that is the furthest rightmost part
is
of.
it though? Is that how? Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you're right.
So I
Yeah.
don't think there are different like governing bodies or owning any entities, so to say.
Well, but in theory, they could be. Because they like every dot can be delegated differently. Like,
This would be delegated somewhere, and then the thing to the left of this could be delegated somewhere. But if there's nothing to the left, then this is delegated one place.
right,
But
but
yeah, it could
my,
be yeah, exactly. They could
yes.
delegate it to Matt Calhoun here.
Yeah, that's my
That I
point.
agree with. Exactly. But the registrar record, so to say, would be themselves.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
What was I going to say? But yeah, that would be pretty remarkable. The first $1 billion domain sale, probably. At today's valuations, I guess that wouldn't really work because then they could delegate others. You would have to own the records themselves to control delegation.
Yeah, or you have to have an agreement in place, basically. Like if you have an agreement in place with a sovereign nation, that's usually probably pretty well respected, I would guess.
Yeah. Oh, look, you can SSH to CM port 22 in August 23. Crazy. All right. So that was that. Next topic was, the We've talked about this in a similar way. This is affecting open source, but I'm sure anybody who has their security at yourdomain.com getting just tons and tons of frivolous security findings and reports by security researchers or script kiddies running automation on, arguable misconfigurations. Well, this is a little bit more, this is a little worse. This is AI hallucinated vulnerabilities, like in the Curl project, which is, one of the cornerstones of modern internet using anything using the HTTP protocol, basically, in most languages. So they've been getting these phony submissions, and then when they challenge it, then the response they get is equally bizarre and AI generated. And this makes me think about somehow like what's awesome about think tools like Cursor and the vibe coding is, yeah, you as a developer move a lot faster, but what really sucks is the recipient of it who has to do that much more code review. And this is that applied to security. Like it's cool that I guess you can try and do this, but it sucks that they're just totally fraudulent alerts, and now you're wasting real, open source contributors' time and who aren't getting, paid for that BS. So I think it's really unfortunate, and I think it's bad because it's tarnishing an overall good reputation that security researchers have, and making that a cringeworthy job title almost soon when I get these fraudulent submissions from security researchers. Any thoughts on this one?
This does resemble the, I think every October, GitHub does that push of, hey, you should go out and help PRs, which have the help wanted PRs. And I think the last few years, a lot of open source maintainers have brought up there is just poor quality of updates, and more almost all of them are just adding a period to the README, which not ideal.
People are just gaming the system instead of
That's it.
competing in the spirit of the initiative. This is why we can't have good things.
It's too true.
I also think like there's a lot. I know some people that maintain some fairly popular open source, and they're telling me that now because it's become so easy for like AI tools to do these things, they're getting a lot of PRs for features that haven't even been like requested or discussed in like in the issues or whatever. They'll just get a PR that's open for this new feature, and they're like, where did this come from? And then they're like, why did someone write, 4,000 lines of code for something that we didn't even say we wanted as part of the project or would accept or whatever, so I think apparently that's happening a lot too. So people are pointing these AI tools at the repository saying, figure out what this thing does and add this feature. And then all of a sudden they just get this giant PR and they're like, why?
I could also see this as a growth hacking stunt by one of the 2,000 AI startups in this space trying to do the same thing, where like, let's just spray and pray. Let's see if we can get one of these automated contributions that cost us only CPU, token credit to do into a mainstream project. They don't care which one. They get one of those, and now that's, dude, AI, engineer introduces new feature into curl. Project, the and then it just comes back to this whole thing about the terror I think open source companies have or open source projects have of another one of those supply chain vulnerability or supply chain attacks that affected the XZ package last year. Was it last year or the year before then? I can't even remember. Time goes so fast.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
As I often tell you, I can't remember what I did last week. Never mind what year some vulnerability came out. Before we go too far, I was just thinking on the dotless domains, how it was like hello at MR or whatever that email address was. I was just thinking about every email validation library in the world is going to reject that. Probably because there's no dot in there, they're gonna all say, "Yeah, that's an invalid email address. You can't email to that." So I was just thinking like how cool it would be to have that domain, and then I was like, no, it wouldn't, because your email would be constantly getting rejected as not a real email. So
Yeah. Or like the people who have a legitimate last name of null, and how many times those people have trouble.
yeah.
It surprises me.
I guess if you really want to flash out, you could just buy your own TLD. There's that
No,
approach.
because those are ICANN accredited, and ICANN, when you become ICANN accredited, you can't do that. What I thought you were going to say is you can just go out and buy your own nation these days,
Well, yeah, of course, naturally. I could be wrong. I linked one of these picked, and I think it's one of those financial companies, but they, I think, went to ICANN and gave them something between 10 to 15K or something. And they just bought their TLD. So their name is Pictet. They bought
Yeah, well, like
their
AWS has .aws. I think the
That's it.
contribution is greater. I thought it was several hundred thousand. I thought it was like off top, I would have guessed 400,000, but maybe it is less.
I bet ICANN wants to make this as vague as possible.
You can legitimately buy, like, you can buy an island in the Bahamas for like under $1 million. And you can turn it into your own sovereign nation. But I have a friend who actually owns one. And he was telling me that he looked into like declaring it his own country, and all the red tape and bureaucracy that it was going to take to get that done, he just said was not worth it at the end of the day, because like you don't get, you have to then negotiate all your own like territorial water things and like all these crazy like treaties and all that kind of stuff. Oh yeah, I remember that. That was the day where the data center was, right?
What's the latest news on this one? Anyone have the latest?
I don't know. That's like 20 years ago or something, right? When
Well, I
they
mean,
did
it was,
that.
I mean, in the last 10 years, it was also with the rise of, or yeah, it was around 2007 with Pirate Bay and places like that. But
I'm looking at
so.
the website and it looks like you could be a citizen for $9.99.
So
Citizen.
their passports are no longer eligible. So that for a while, they were legit passports from the Principality of Sealand, but then there were some shady people who ended up getting it, and now it's like not accepted anywhere. So that just goes to show what the value of your Sealand passport is now. Yeah, interesting. All right, so namespaces in Kubernetes are now enabled by default, meaning you don't need to pass any specific flags to the kube daemon processes. This is really cool. The way this works, or why this is cool, first of all. So, it's been a long talk about like rootless containers, or like how do you safely handle root with containers. And the problem is that on the kernel, the UID 0, for example, is a very privileged ID. And that's true for any system ID on the host machine. So what if instead you mapped every ID in the container to some ephemeral ID on the host that isn't used by anything else and guaranteed not to be used by anything else? Now you can basically ensure that even if you escape the jail of the container, you can't escape the jail on the host. At least so is the story. And it's pretty easy to enable once you upgrade. You just set the sec under security context somewhere. First, you have to opt in the pod to this feature, which is not by default, I believe. And then there's host users false, and then now your UID is never mapped to any UID on the host machine where the container is running.
But what if you're running more than 4 billion pods on your Kubernetes cluster?
Exactly.
Is that it, right? It's a 32-bit integer, right? The UID.
It's a and not a UUID, but
The actual user ID, right? So I think that's, if my math is right, I think that's right. It's about 4 billion total UIDs you could have.
I thought it was actually, I thought it's 32K is the largest. So largest positive integer. And I think it's
Yeah, I think that's 4.2 billion or something like that, right?
you
Two
know.
to the 32nd minus one would be the math if it's a 32-bit integer.
Isn't it though like half of that or something when you factor out negative integers or something?
That's the minus one.
Oh,
Yeah. I think my math is right. I think my math is right on this one. I think it's slightly over here.
It's
It's
just
yeah. 4,294,967,295. There you go.
all right, let's see here. So next, like thing that caught my attention here. Amazon Labs, not to be confused with Amazon IC or Amazon Samples or any of the other many.
IA, right? Isn't that the
Oh,
other one?
IA, not IC.
Yeah.
So this is kind of cool. It's an MCP that lets you talk to that lets your agent talk to CloudWatch logs. When combined, therefore, with say, like maybe your Terraform MCP and why the F this thing isn't working, it can then see the logs to see that this is why it's not working. That could maybe speed up the feedback cycle.
Yeah, just run npx run blah 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 and pass it your AWS credentials in clear text and hope for the best. Like, that's the biggest thing of all these MCPs that I see is that they're almost all like npm packages that just expect you to pass in whatever credentials you
The
need on the
credential.
command line to them. So yeah. You know, it's vibe security, I guess, too.
I'm sure you could just
Good.
ask one to design a more secure, set of roles for your MCPs, right?
And have the MCP write it. No conflict of interest.
Exactly. What could go wrong?
Right. And well, that's what let me do things out of order. There's a nice promotion for Matt Gowey. They just wrote a or Weston Platter, who works with Matt Gowey at MasterPoint. They just did a write-up on using MCPs to run Terraform. We talked about it in office hours a couple months ago. I think somebody whipped up a MCP for Terraform, this TF MCP. So they follow the instructions and go through the setup process that they took and were able to at least get it to solve something. Like with anything and with MCPs and vibing, I think there's a skill set that goes along with it to be effective with it, and what problems it'll work well with. So their conclusion was, I think, it has potential, but it still required a lot of experience for it to be useful. And that jives with my understanding too.
At the beginning, I think one of the topics you had was licenses and respecting licenses. I wonder how MCPs will come at that, if certain tools and software have different licenses, or if they change midway through, will an
Yeah.
MCP take that into consideration?
No.
No, okay.
I mean, one can try best effort. You can say, I never want, such and such licenses, and that can hopefully influence it. But A, it's not going to be timely. It's going to be most likely when the model is created. It's probably not going to go out and research it. But what's cool is that the more structured data there is for these things, the easier you can make it, then I think the MCPs and the agents can help you do that.
It'd be very interesting to, not that I want to dredge up old wounds or whatever, but it'd be very interesting to see what the legal opinion is of using an MCP to run Terraform would be for on the BSL license permitted uses, because they were very restrictive about like what how you could run it, what tools could be running it, the kit. Like that seems like a
I think it would
third-party
explode the
tool.
context window. I couldn't figure it out.
I don't actually mean asking a language model to do it. I actually mean like in Terraform's BSL or Bousal or however the heck they wrote it. I think that my interpretation would be that using an MCP to run a Bousal licensed Terraform version would actually be a violation of their license terms because of the way that they've written it about third-party tools running Terraform and helping Terraform. So
If it competes with one of their offerings, no?
yeah, sort of. That's only one part. And that's why I said I didn't want to get in, necessarily get into the whole debate, but it would be an interesting
It's an
read.
interesting philosophical one, yeah.
Just the thought.
I think
Like
about
all the unintended consequences of like when they wrote that, no one had an idea what an MCP was. Never mind like wrote the license for intending not or intending for it to be used or not to be used. So now you live with however it's written and you wonder, what do, kind of thing. It's interesting.
Two more announcements. One was just the one I skipped here. Matt, you brought this to my attention. So Azure is providing a way to export to raw TF, raw HCL rather, your some configuration. I don't know what the scope of that is or what you can do. There's a CLI tool though that they wrote, right? Yeah, AZ TF export written in Go. So that's kind of cool.
And basically you just select the resources that you want and it essentially like exports. I mean, again, we've talked about this, with all the generation tools we've seen in the past where you can yes, you will generate a Terraform module that can recreate that stuff, but it is definitely not going to be like a best
This is a
practices
simple, yeah.
reusable module. It's going to be every single like resource just scripted out for you. Which if you have to migrate accounts or do something like that, it's probably useful. But it's probably not useful to actually run your business this way, with that generation. But I just thought it was interesting that it's like natively supported by Microsoft at this point.
Yeah. So it would be like an imperative snapshot of literally everything. But maybe, together with other tooling out there, pretty awesome. Like co combine that with Copilot agents or Cursor or Windsurf for refactoring, and could be a good way at scale to migrate lots of projects over.
Yeah, or like run it every day in cron and get a way to do BCP if like you lose your entire Azure
Yeah.
account or something like that. You could bring it back up exactly as it is very easily.
Or yeah, like or the legacy stuff also you just don't care about, but you at least want some way to do it. So yeah, that's another good use case. Good point. All right. Last one was Terraform BSL 1.12 was released today. One of the things that it adds is OCI storage. Yeah. Oh, it's Oracle Cloud Storage. Yeah, not that exciting. Everyone that I know was hoping it was going to be the container format, OCI images. They've added parallelism to the test functionality, which is pr probably pretty nice. And
The one that I wish has been there for a long time is the second one in enhancements, is that logical operators now short circuit, so you don't like if you match one, it doesn't run the other side of the
that was so annoying. Yeah. So if it was an so if it mapped to something invalid at that time, the whole expression was invalid, even though it should have passed. So that's pretty nice. All right.
Was
So
this the one where they deprecated something with I saw that they were doing something with the AWS provider that was getting deprecated. I don't remember what it was though. Just
don't see
it didn't
anything.
get
This one didn't say
released,
provider,
but
but this, yeah.
oh yeah, this is that wouldn't be in
Yeah, the
oh wait,
core.
yes it would, because this is the not the back end, AWS back end. I meant the S3 back end. I saw something was being deprecated with that, but I don't remember what it was now, but must be a future release.
Keyword S3 doesn't show up here, or keyword AWS doesn't
Yeah.
show up.
Okay. Must be something future. Oh, that
All
was interesting. It says that you have to have, sorry, not that I want to
right.
keep dropping you back. I just saw that it said you have to have at least kernel 3.2, I think, to run versions of Terraform now. Yeah.
Interesting. I would have never understood or realized, never made a connection between the kernel version.
I guess it must be whatever standard libraries they're compiling against now. Like they must not support something that's in the, or they don't want to continue to test against older kernel versions than
Well, it
that, I
sounds like
guess.
it's something also related to going to Go 1.24.
Probably. Could
Could it be something with the new parallelism too?
All right. So yeah, that's that. Let's get into Q&A. And I know we had a question or two in the channel, so let me go read what we have here. Starting at the first one, Anthony. Hey, my team's new to Terraform. Sorry, to Atmos and new to Terraform. We basically just started using both in the last month. We've been struggling to develop features concurrently on the same component. Quickly, we found Terraform Workspaces as a possible solution to the problem. However, with Atmos, we aren't able to copy or branch from the main workspace to a new feature workspace. So instead, that has caused a different problem that Atmos wanted to create all the new resources that we've previously imported. And that's un so that's untenable. So without a better path forward, I submitted a feature request to Atmos earlier today, but we are wondering how other teams have handled this problem. We really want to be able to deploy changes to our engineering environment before opening a pull request and merging to the main branch, while also being able to develop features on the same component concurrently. Anthony, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm
Yep.
still here.
All right, cool. Matt, do you want to take a pass at this one?
I think there's a lot to unpack there.
It is.
And so in the way that Atmos works, a workspace is not tied to the actual component itself. It's tied to like the component instance, if you will. Like, right. So like an actual instantiation of a stack, or of a component in a stack. So if you have the VPC component in your, you know, dev environment, that's one workspace, and the VPC component in your prod workspace is a different, or in your prod environment is a different workspace. So I'm trying to understand, are you not using them in like that, or like I guess I don't fully understand the question, because you should be able to, as an example, just iterate in dev and not change anything to do with any other environment, and then when you're ready you can merge that PR, which then would roll that change across all of your environments that are using that VPC component. Can you elaborate a little bit more?
Yeah, so and this might be a problem that's unique to the particular cloud provider that we're using, but the situation that we're in is we have one engineering environment, right? We have one instance, one cloud provider, one URL that we're interacting with. But what we want to be able to do
is, let's say developer Bob is developing feature A, and developer Sally is working on feature B. These are completely separate features, but they both belong to the same exact component. And what we want to be able to do is independently deploy those changes out to that one engineering instance. However, what we're running into is that because we are sharing this instance that we are applying these changes to, what'll end up happening is the last one that applies those changes wins and blows away the changes that the other developer did previously.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there's a way for us to still allow them to independently deploy their changes without destroying the changes that the other one had made.
Yeah, I think the uniqueness of just having one single like account. So like if we boil this all down under the hood, Terraform is calling some API on your cloud provider and it's saying like create resource foo. And then your cloud provider is giving back a unique ID. ID 1234 is the resource foo. And then now you have two different people who are making changes that are mutating resource foo, and the cloud provider is doing the right thing. It's, whoever said made the change, make the change last is the person who's getting their thing applied last. Like, and so I think that that makes sense. I think the easiest thing to do if you're working in a scenario like that would essentially be to create a copy of the thing that you're working on. So if you have it named foo in both of them, obviously they're going to conflict. But if while you're working on a new feature you call it foo-test or something like that, then foo-test will be mutated by the person who's working in, or foo-test 1 and test 2. Then they each get their own test resource, and then when you've kind of tested it all and you're ready to merge, then you rename them back to foo and let Terraform do its thing and mutate the real foo resource. At least that's the best like thing I could come up with in this case to do that.
So let me describe the situation again, because what you're describing is a little bit different, and I agree that that's what I would expect to happen in that scenario. If we were both developing on foo resource, like we're just overriding each other, this would be more like, let's say one developer is working on an S3 bucket named foo, and at the same time, some other developer in another branch is working on an S3 bucket named bar, right? And they have both applied their changes. Whoever applied first, theirs gets created, but the person who applies that resource second, they're going to end up blowing away the other's S3 bucket and creating their own.
Let me bring in some meta here if I because I saw your issue as well, and I think that impacts it's a departure from how we think about some things. And it'll be more clear in a second. Let me just pull that up here. So if we go into the feature branch development. So first of all, let me say, like, in a perfect world, totally agree. I like this idea. This is like with, Git, you can just branch and start working on something new. That's how we would love things to work. Neon database just acquired by Databricks yesterday or today can do that with databases. Super cool. So get the intent there. I just don't know that Terraform as a language has the maturity to do exactly that, but I think there's some other things we can talk about. First, I want to point out one thing that you mentioned here is that you have something that you deployed with 10,000 resources. If you were talking about Atmos, it sounds like you have a component, so some root module that is managing a ton of resources. And if developer A and developer B are working on that same configuration or that same module, yes, I could see them blowing each other away by the architecture of the Terraform code. But if we change the architecture of the Terraform code so that it is smaller, so that the instance, so to take your example of the bucket, they're operating on two totally separate buckets, but the problem stems from, in your example, that they are managed by the same root module. In our mental model for how this stuff is supposed to work, is that they're separated by SDLC. And typically the bucket would have its own SDLC. So we would have a component instance of bucket A, and we would have a component instance of bucket B. And therefore, the life cycle A is never coupled with the life cycle of B. And in your scenario, this doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah, and actually
Interesting. Okay.
the problem you describe is like a perfect example of why we advocate for decomposing teraliths down into much smaller, like usable components, because every time you touch that teralith, like a monolithic Terraform module, you run the risk of breaking something that you didn't intend to break or deploy or do whatever, because they're all part of one thing. If they were each their own independent thing, as Eric was talking about, you have the freedom to do exactly what I said, is like the person could be one person could be iterating on bucket A and one person could be iterating on bucket B, and never shall their path meet because they're working on two different instances altogether of code there. And I misunderstood from the beginning. I thought that's what you were doing, and you were just running into some sort of issue. But it makes more sense if it's like, if it's a bigger monolith and that's the problem. So, yeah.
Any follow-up questions to that?
This is probably not unique to Atmos, but maybe you guys might have a suggestion or an answer. But is it possible to output something from a root component to another root component and import it into that other root? Okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's m many ways of doing it. We describe all of those different ways on the Atmos documentation, and we call it this section here, share data between components. So
Okay.
we point out a few ways to do it in Atmos, first of all. So one is the store method, which we recommend a lot. It's the fastest way to do it, is the store method. But you can use Terraform outputs, so you can get the outputs from something else. This is also a Atmos way of doing it. You can use Atmos functions, which we describe here. And then you can also use actual Terraform remote state itself. Here's an example of using it with a remote state module that we've developed for Atmos, but you can also just do it in vanilla Terraform. So like what we're talking about is Terraform data source remote state. So this is how you get the state from other root modules.
Okay. Yeah, then I think maybe what we've been doing is using like basically a child module for every single conceptual thing inside of this provider. And maybe the better answer is don't use those child modules, use root modules and share data that way.
Yeah.
A hybrid
Okay.
model. Yeah, you more or less got it correct. And I don't want to necessarily confuse you, but sometimes.